This week's parasha, Tamar proves that Yehuda is the father of her children by presenting him with his cloak and his ring and his staff, which he recognizes to be his own. Without the benefit of testimony, he assumes that these are his children because of these identifying items. And therefore, I wanted to take the opportunity to discuss a contemporary paternity test in the absence of testimony. Can we determine that a person is considered to be the father of a child based on identifying evidence or items or characteristics without the benefit of a testimony or the usual circumstances that we have in determining paternity and parental relationship? So the in the 1960s, they were developed, before then it really didn't exist, a paternity test based on proteins that were found on blood cells, genetic material and proteins, called human leukocyte antigen blood test. So it's known as HLA blood test. And it was had a fairly high level of accuracy. So can that be acceptable in the eyes of halacha to establish paternity for financial issues and for other issues as well? So it was somewhat controversial when this emerged on the scene in the 1960s in Eretz Yisrael, because the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Nidan, Daf Lamed Amud Beis, that there are shloisha shut v'niyesh ba'adam. There are three parties that participate in the creation of human beings. There's HaKadosh Baruch Hu, V'av V'imai, the two parents, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the basis for the Gemara Masechtas Kiddushin that tells us that the Kibud Av V'Im is not only a mitzvah that is ben adam lechaveroi, and it's a personal mitzvah that a person is obligated to demonstrate gratitude to his parents for all that they do for him, but it's also a mitzvah that is ben adam lemakom, a religious mitzvah, because by honoring a person's parents, he's in effect honoring the entire partnership and the Ribono Shel Olam as well. So if you honor your parents, it's a kilu you're honoring HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well, because there are shlosh shut v'niyesh ba'adam. However, the Gemara Masechtas Nida elaborates that what does each party contribute to the creation of a human being? So the Gemara says that each parent contributes five items. The father contributes mazria haloiben, the white parts of the body. The mother contributes mazras oidem, she contributes the red parts of the body. And the Kadosh Baruch Hu contributes, those are all, five of the father, five of the mother are physical characteristics. The Kadosh Baruch Hu comes and he bestows more of the spiritual aspects of the body, the five senses, the neshama, the klas terpanim, hiluch raglaim, ubina v'haseichos. So Kadosh Baruch Hu contributes 10. Each one of the parents contributes 5. The father contributes the white parts of the body. The mother contributes the red parts of the body. That's why the Rebbe Reb Heschel writes in the Sefer Chanukah Satorah that when the pasuk says Adam Harishon is created, that describes the creation of Adam Harishon in Parshas Bereishis, Vayitza Hashem Elokim Esa Adam Afer Min Adam, Kadosh Baruch Hu created Adam Harishon from the dust of the earth. There's two yuds in the word Vayitza. Subsequently, there's only one yud in Parshas Bereishis. The first time it appears, there's two yuds. Why two yuds? So Chazal make many comments on that pasuk. B'shnei Yitzirecha, the Yitzar Atoiv, the Yitzar Hara. However, the Rebbe Reb Heschel explains that it's because most people, when they're created, so each one of their parents donates 5 items. Father 5, the mother 5, and Kadosh Baruch Hu only has to donate 10. However, by Adam Harishon, he had no biological parents. So Kadosh Baruch Hu had to donate all 20. So that's why it's two yuds. He had to donate the 5 of the father and the 5 of the mother. That's the first yud. The second yud is the 10 things that Kadosh Baruch Hu usually contributes to every child. However, the father contributes the items mazria haloiben, the 5 things that are the white parts of the body, the atzamos, the gidim, the tzibarnaim, the mayor shabarosh, the loiben shabayin. The mother contributes the red parts of the body, the blood, the ar, the basa, the cyrus, and the shachar shabayin. The paiskim therefore debated how this should relate to blood tests. Is this considered to be a halachic statement of the Gemara, or is this more of an agadic statement of the Gemara? So it happens to be that the Rishonim actually cite this Gemara lehalacha. Over here in Shulchan Aruch and Hilchas Mila, the Shulchan Aruch quotes from the Gemara Masechtas Yevamos that if a person has a child who lo aleinu dies during Mila, probably because he has a blood clotting disorder, and then another child is born, another son, so they perform Mila, and lo aleinu, the child passes away. Again, because of the bris Mila. So when a person has a third child, the pattern has already been established, but when he has a third child, you don't perform the bris Mila, we're afraid he's going to suffer a similar fate. So Shulchan Aruch's opinion is that that applies both to brothers that are brothers, paternal brothers, as well as maternal brothers. Even if they don't share both of the same parents, if either they share the same father or the same mother, this pattern has been established, and we wouldn't do bris milah on the third child. The Ramah disagrees. The Ramah writes over here, this pattern is only established if they are brothers from the same mother. If they're brothers from the same father, then the pattern has not been established. And you would do bris milah on the third child, even though his older two brothers perished from doing the bris milah. So, the truth of the matter is, what the Shulchan Aruch seems to be discussing is hemophilia, which is a blood clotting disorder. Hemophilia is a genetic disorder that's linked to the X chromosome, which I don't mean to get too biological on you, but the X chromosome is usually, in a boy, is donated by the mother. And a girl could be donated by the father or the mother. So if a girl is a hemophiliac, she might have gotten it from the father's X chromosome or the mother's X chromosome. However, a boy is an XY. He gets the Y from the father, the X from the mother. So if a boy is a hemophiliac, he can only have gotten it from the mother, because it's linked to the X chromosome. So the Ramah, therefore, happens to be accurate in the sense that biologically or genetically, that if a child is a hemophiliac, he only could have gotten it from the mother. So it only makes sense to establish a pattern if you're dealing with three brothers that share the same mother, not three brothers that share the same father. If one was a hemophiliac, we could presume that the others would be hemophiliacs as well. However, that's not what prompted the Ramah to make his comment, is because he was aware that hemophilia is a genetic disorder that's linked to the X chromosome. The Ramah is quoting from the Chiddush, from the Sefer Aguda, one of the Rishonim, is basing himself on the Gemara Masechtas Nida, that the Gemara tells us who contributes the blood to the baby. They knew that this was a blood clotting disorder, but who contributes the blood? The mother, not the father. So the mother contributes the red parts of the body, Mazra Soedem, the blood, the Or, the Batz, the Cyrus, and the Shachash Ba'ayin. So therefore, if there's a blood clotting disorder in the family, it must be that it's from the mother. And therefore, it's only if they're brothers because they share the same mother, not if they're paternal brothers just because they share the same father. So the Aguda, quoted by the Ramah, seems to cite this Gemara not only as an agadic statement of the Gemara, but also a halachic statement relevant in Hilchas Milah. So because of that, when this issue arose in the 1960s, the Sephardi chief rabbi in Eretz Yisrael was Rav Ben Zion Uziel, very prolific author as well. And he argued, as well as Tzitz Eliezer, who was the Poisik of Shaarei Tzedek Hospital, a very astute in medical issues, and well-known, renowned in medical issues, groundbreaking in medical ethics, and Rav Avadya Yosef, all felt that you cannot rely on a paternity test that's using genetic material and proteins attached to the blood cells to determine paternity, because the father doesn't donate the blood, the mother is the one who donates the blood. At the same time, when this issue was being debated, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi of Eretz Yisrael was Rabbi Herzog. Rabbi Herzog, who has a PhD and other degrees, so Rabbi Herzog wrote an article in disagreement, a dissenting opinion, which was published in a medical journal called Sefer Asya, which I gave you over here, Oiz Gimel, where he writes, Chaval, it's disappointing. As long as science is continuing to march forward and make new discoveries, even though occasionally, admittedly, they do make mistakes, but with regard to scientific issues that impact upon the way that we keep the Torah and the mitzvahs, we put our head into the sand like the ostrich, and we seem to ignore all of the advancements that are going on around us. And that was disappointing. Why are we not recognizing, of course, the validity and the accuracy of a paternal blood test? Yeah.
So is he saying that you should be able to use it, or is he just questioning?
No, he argued that it should be able to be used. And Shlomo Zalman agreed that when the Gemara said that the mother donates the red and not the father, that was probably an agadic statement of the Gemara, even though the Sefer Aguda does cite it in Hilchos Milah. Shlomo Zalman felt that we shouldn't necessarily conclude, understand the Gemara in its simplest fashion. Perhaps it means something that's much a deeper concept and more nuanced. But Shlomo Zalman argued that perhaps the level of accuracy of paternity tests don't rise to the level of accuracy that we should require to establish paternity, because it was above 90%, but it wasn't infallible. So, or even to the level that we're going to get to in a second with regards to DNA testing. It wasn't to that threshold. So therefore, Shlomo Zalman argued it's a right, but it's not necessarily the majority of the time it's a right, but it's not necessarily the accuracy we would require. Yeah.
Question on the Gemara. When it says Odem, is that referring to anything non-white, really?
Well, the Gemara lists five things: dam, or basar. Yeah, correct.
So is it anything non-white?
Right. I don't really think it means white and red. Like we understood it, it means different types of items. There was another though motivation for the Paiskim not to accept, or even those, let's say, who would accept the accuracy of paternity tests, there still is a motivation not to order a paternity test when there is a monetary dispute over who is a rightful heir to an estate or not. The typical time you would have a paternity test is when a father claims that the child who the wife is claiming to be his child is not his child. He doesn't want him to share in a portion of the estate. So there is a great motivation not to order a paternity test in that situation. Because the Sefer Chassidim actually quotes from Rav Sadia Gaon from the period of the Gaonim that they had a paternity test, a blood test that they used to establish paternity. And he discusses in the following situation of a man who had a child, who was presumed to be his biological child, and an Eved. And after the person's death, the Eved claimed that he was an illegitimate child of this person as well. And he was rightfully entitled to a portion of the estate. And a dispute arose. Should only the biological son Yarshin, or should the Eved Yarshin as well? After all, he was claiming that he was a rightful heir. So Rav Sadia Gaon instructed them to take blood from the biological son, take blood from the Eved, and take a bone, and put each one in a beaker or a container, and then take a bone from the deceased father. Put the bone in the blood of each beaker, each container. And they put the blood in the biological son's, they put the bone in the beaker containing the blood of the biological son, and the bone absorbed the blood. And then they put it in the blood of the Eved, and the bone did not absorb the blood of the Eved. They determined from the fact that they absorbed the blood of the biological son that he must be a rightful heir, and that did not absorb the blood of the Eved, there must be that they are not biologically related, and therefore didn't absorb the blood, and he was not considered to be a rightful heir. So this sounds like a very ancient paternity, blood paternity test established by testing the blood of the father against the son. However, the Rashash, in light of that, the fact that they had this ancient paternity test, why don't we find it used in the Gemara, particularly in the following dilemma? The Gemara Masechta Baba Basra over here at Daf Nun Ches Amud Aleph discusses the situation of a woman who had 10 sons. However, the father revealed on his deathbed only one of them is his. The rest are not his children. Hach Issa Sarah Bani Isla, there was a similar woman who had 10 sons. Only one was a biological son of the father, though. They were all her children. The rest were from an extramarital affair. So, the father, when he passed away, he said, all my estate should go to my one biological son, not to the other ones. But we didn't know which one. He didn't specify which one was the biological son and which one wasn't. So, you have 10 potential heirs, but only one is the biological son. The rest are from a different man. So, how are we supposed to figure out who is the biological son? So, Rav Benah instructed them all to go to the Beis HaKvaris, take a stick, and hit the kever of the father. 9 went, and 1 refused to go. Sounds like Shlomo HaMelech. 1 refused to go. So, he said, Ahud Debreid, Hav Eloi Ozel. It must be the son is the one who wouldn't go, and under no circumstances would he hit the kever of his father. Amalahu kuhu nasi dahai, all the estate belongs to that one individual. So he made a kind of psychological exam to figure out which one of the children was the real biological child, which one were from the extramarital affair. So, but the Rashash asks, why didn't he use the blood test of Reb Sadia Gaon? That's really conclusive. This is a psychological test, Not that conclusive, but this is even more conclusive, absolute. So Rashash says, Mishum Dal Yedei Nisayin, the Sefer Chassidim, Yizkal Hashem Amzeirim, because there's a downside to establishing paternity. Not only you can find out who's the rightful heir when you're distributing an estate, but the downside is most of these situations, you're going to establish someone as a mamzer. And that is detrimental to him and to the entire community. We don't want that. And that's what he says over here. He's gashim mamzerim. He didn't want this to be revealed that they were all mamzerim. Which one were mamzerim? His test of who would go and hit the kever just revealed who had a greater sensitivity to the death of the father. And that's how the Rosh Hashanah concludes. So we don't want to reveal that someone is a mamzer. What do you tell me? You'll tell me either they're a mamzer or they're not. If they're a mamzer, even if we don't reveal it, they're a mamzer. So the truth of the matter is that that's not the case. The Gemara tells us in Masechet this Kiddushin, Daf Ayin Aleph, Amud Aleph, Mishpoch Shenitma Nitma. Once a family has become assimilated with Mamzerim, it's become confused, we don't look underneath the rock. We let the situation exist as it is. We don't know with certainty that someone is a Mamzer. We let it ride. Because the Gemara tells us in Masechet this Kiddushin, and Gimel Amud Aleph, commenting on the Pasuk and Parshas Kisei, so the Yovah, Mamzer, Bekal Hashem, a Mamzer should not come. Enter into the Kal Hashem, is not allowed to marry a Bas Yisrael. Mamzer vaday hu delo yavay, ha mamzer safek yavay. Only a person who's a mamzer with absolute certainty is not allowed to marry a Bas Yisrael, but someone who there's a safek, there's a doubt about his status as a mamzer, is allowed to marry a Bas Yisrael. Any doubt. And even though we generally have a rule, the Ran writes in Masechet Kiddush, and even though we generally have a rule, safek deiraisa luchumra, when you have a suffolk Iser, we go to Chumrah, we prohibit it nonetheless. There's a Xeris HaKosav here, that Mamzer only applies if it's absolutely certain there's a Mamzer. If it's just a suffolk, we can be Mekel. Suffolk, Mamzer, Lukula. And the Ran compares it to a similar type of exception to the rule of suffolk Deraisa Lukumrah with regards to Arla and Chutz La'aretz. Arla is the prohibition to eat from the fruits of a tree during the first 3 years of the life of the tree. Midaraisa that applies in Eretz Yisrael, that's a pasuk in the Torah, Parshas Kedoshim, but it also applies in Chutz La'aretz, but in Chutz La'aretz it's only Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai. So the Gemara tells us over here in the second line of Vayis Ches, with regards to Halacha L'Moshe Mi'Sinai of Arlon Chutz La'aretz, it was articulated, it was what it was initially given, part of the tradition of Arlon Chutz La'aretz was Sfeika Mutav Ador Aser. That if it's a suffix, any measure of doubt at all, Arla and Chutz La'aretz becomes permitted. It's only if it's absolute certainty that it's Arla, then it's Aser, otherwise it's permitted. To the degree, if you look on the first line, the middle of the line, Rabbi Via Rabbi Barab Chanan, Sefuki Misafki La'adadi, they would take it, Arla and Chutz La'aretz, which they knew was Arla, and mix it up, confuse it with other similar fruits, and then they would eat it. Even though they knew before which one was Arla, which one wasn't, you artificially confuse it as well, it's also permitted. And even more than that, Reb Levi said to Shmuel, Safik Levana Echo. Shmuel knew which one was Arla, which one wasn't, but Levi didn't. So even if one party knows about it, the other party doesn't, that's still a Safik. Either we artificially created the Safik, or even if one party knows, the other party doesn't, for him he's allowed to eat it, he's not. Because for him it's a Safik, even though someone else knows. So that's why Rav Chanan Wasserman published an article in a journal called Degel HaTorah, that a person, years ago obviously, that a person, let's say there's a Masada Kiddushin, who knows that this child is a mamzer, but the child himself doesn't know. The Kala doesn't know. He could be Masada Kiddushin for the couple, knowing that he's a mamzer and she's a regular Bas Yisrael. Because since he doesn't know and she doesn't know, there's no Iser. Suffolk mamzer is mutter. So therefore, certainly, to go out of our way, therefore Rabbi Yashiv writes in his Chuvis Kovitz, Chuvis and many Poskim felt, to use a paternity test. That's why the Israeli courts will very rarely order a paternity test, even in a dispute over an estate and things like that, because in support, because if we find out that it's not his child, then it's the child could be a mamzer, which is going to create a whole host of problems. If we don't know, we don't know. Moms are vadai, veloy moms are suffolk, then it's everything is fine. But if we order a paternity test, someone's going to be, might be found out to be a momzer, and that is going to create other problems. So that was one motivation, even for those who accepted, that's why even Rabbi Herzog and others who accepted the paternity test, they very rarely came up, because in most situations, not in every situation, but in most situations, you run the risk of creating momzerim, and that's something that we go to great lengths to avoid. Mishprocha shenitma nitma. However, more recent years, The issue has moved away from paternity tests and inheritance disputes, and we have more, much more accurate tests with regards to DNA testing. And DNA testing is not only taken from the blood, of course. You could do it, everybody knows, you could take any part of the body, which all parts of the body have DNA, and can be used for analysis, some better than others. But DNA can be found in other parts of the body, which are clearly contributed by both the mother and the father. So you don't run afoul of the Gemara Maseches Nida. And DNA testing, though, usually comes up in an entirely different situation, not in a dispute about an estate, but in establishing that a husband in a tragic situation of a guna, you have a woman who's married to a husband who disappears. Or how we find remains of the husband, but we can't positively identify him because the face is unrecognizable. So can we use DNA evidence to presume that these are the remains of the husband and allow his wife to remarry? So the truth of the matter is, in this week's parsha, Yaakov Avinu is presented with the kesenes of Yosef dipped in blood. And they asked him, "Haker no hakesenes bin chahi ablai? Is this the kesenes pasim of your son Yosef?" And Yaakov Avinu positively identifies it as being his garment. Yaakov Avinu tears kriya and he sits shiva for Yosef. He began to sit avelos. Even though there was no testimony that Yosef had died, he just concluded that based on the evidence that he was presented with his kesenes dipped in blood. And that's relevant to the issue of whether or not we could use other forms of evidence to establish that a husband passed away and allow his wife to remarry. Because the Shulchan Aruch tells us, in Huchas Avelus, over here, Ois Yud, Shem, and Shin, Sadi, Zayin, Sif, Aleph, that Mis'aban al Piyed Echad, you can sit Avelus, begin to start, commence Avelus, once you have testimony of one witness that the person passed away. Even if it's hearsay, even if it's from an Oved Kechavim, Mesiach, Lefitumai, he doesn't realize that he's giving you critical information, he's just discussing the case, this is the situation. If he realizes that you're significant in our eyes, he might lie. But if he doesn't realize that it's going to be significant for us, he's Mesiach Lefituma, we can accept his testimony as well to commence Avelus. And the Shach explains in the name of the Ramban, Kasva Ramban, Zehaklal, this is the rule. Kol Eidah Shemesiyim Isha Alpiha Hakrevim Misavlim. The same standard that we have in order to allow a woman to remarry, to assume her husband is dead, which again is also with one witness. Even hearsay, certain situations, sometimes even psulei eidos, is generally the same standard as eid echa nema bisurin. Like a person who tells you food is kosher, you could believe him, so too with regards to the death of the husband, to allow a woman to remarry. Even though, generally we have a rule, by davar shebi erva, matters of marriage and divorce, ein davar shebi erva pachos mishnayim, you need two witnesses. Here, Chazal introduced a special leniency in order to alleviate the difficulty of guna situations, to allow her to remarry even with one witness, even with someone who's a possibly eidos. A special kula of Chazal in this situation of a guna, to allow her to remarry and assume that the husband is dead, if you get testimony of rising to the level of like an eid echa neman bisurin. So that's the standard as well in order to commence avelos. Why? Presumably it's because we didn't want the ironic or paradoxical situation of a woman sitting shiva for a husband because she assumes he's dead, but she's still not allowed to remarry. That's the kind of tension would be untenable. So you say, okay, so fine. That's what you need in order to establish someone's dead to begin avelus for a woman who's married. What about in other situations? Is someone not married, a single person, who we discover remains and, some identifying, we get less than this, can we perhaps assume that that's good enough to begin Avelos even though we don't have the testimony of one witness? So the Rebbe Kiva Eger over here, of course, from the Sefer Ezra Snashim and also from the Shach, that no, this applies indiscriminately, we don't distinguish across the board, and that is that in order to begin, commence Avelos, the same standard applies to establishing, it's just like you need one witness to establish a husband is dead and allow a woman to remarry, so too, that's the standard of information that you require in order to begin Avelos, across the board, for everyone, whether they were married or not married, even though we might have been motivated by it to avoid the paradoxical situation, for shitting Shiva, but still not allowed to be remarried, it applies across the board. That's the standard. So if you require one witness to begin Avelos, to assume that the husband was dead, how should we treat other identifying items or other ways of identifying the remains? Should that be considered the equivalent of testimony of one witness? So we know in other areas of halacha, particularly when it comes to dinei nefashos, capital punishment, nothing is the equivalent of testimony. Testimony is absolutely a requirement. The Gemara Masechta Sanhedrin tells us in the name of Rav Shimon ben Shetach that he once walked into a deserted remains, you know, a deserted building, or a destroyed building, and he was there, and then he saw someone run in with a knife in his hand, chasing someone else. And they went behind the wall. 2 seconds later, he sees the other guy come out with a knife dripping with blood, and the other guy is a corpse on the floor. So he says to the guy, either you killed him or I killed him. It's either one of us, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't me. It was you. Nonetheless, Shimon Shetach says, nothing I can do about it. I can't carry out any kind of verdict or punishment. The Torah says you absolutely need the testimony of two witnesses to the action. Otherwise, you can't punish even a murderer. Then the Gemara continues, P.S. Then a snake came along, bit the murderer, and he died. Okay, so the Ribbono Shel Olam exacted punishment. However, you see from this Gemara that testimony of two witnesses is absolutely necessary, indispensable when it comes to a capital case. However, what about to establish that a person has died, to allow the wife to remarry, and to commence Avelos? Can we suffice without testimony? Let's have testimony of one witness, even Sulei Eders. Chazal instituted a leniency in order to alleviate the difficulty of aguna situations. But can we rely upon other indications that are not testimony? Yeah.
Was there really no way in Lava back then to catch any murderer who wasn't witnessed by two people?
Like, yeah, and even if it would be, even if we would know, it's indispensable. You must have two witnesses.
Every single murder that happened back then between two people with no one else around, the guy got away.
Not actionable, yeah. As I said, a Beis Din rarely killed what was once in 70 years, yeah. Very rare. So the truth of the matter is, the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Bar Metzia, if you flip the page, in the context of returning an Aveda with Simanim, with an identifying characteristic, as long as the person comes and he identifies the item, you know, does it have this wrinkle or dent, then you can return the item to him if he can positively identify it. Can we rely on simanim, other identifying characteristics, to assume that the person's remains are of the husband and allow the wife to remarry? So the Gemara tells us, Tashma, based on Ebraisa, Ein me'idim ela parts of hapanim imachaitim. You need testimony of one witness, that he saw the person's face, the profile, with the nose. Without a nose, it's hard to identify the remains. So he has to have the entire profile of the face. Even if there are other, let's say the face is unrecognizable, but there are other identifying characteristics of the body or of his clothing and utensils, that's not good enough. But then the Gemara modifies. That's perhaps only if the identifying quality or characteristic of his body is that it's tall or short, skinny or fat. That's a simon garua. So many people could be described in that way, half the population. It's either tall or short, skinny or fat, or average. I guess there's three possibilities. So, you know, you can't really derive anything or extrapolate anything from that kind of information. Or, you know, or his kalim, he was wearing a red shirt, a white shirt. What does that tell me? Black shirt, a t-shirt. He can't interpret anything from that. However, what if it's a greater simon? It's something that's more rare. So the Gemara says, if it's a simon muvak, even a mole, the Gemara says, yeah, that's more, I guess, conclusive than tall, short, skinny, or fat. That's like a simen beinoni, the Gemara says. That seems to be somewhat of a debate of a shuma, if a mo is considered to be an identifying characteristic. But then the Gemara says there is such a thing as a simen muvak, which is seems to be conclusive, you know, something that's so rare, doesn't exist by others, that can we can identify a person's remains and allow the wife to remarry and to commence avelus. What is considered to be a simen muvak? A reliable simen. So if you look at the Beis Shmuel, in his comments on Shulchan Aruch, I gave it to you over here, Ois Yudalid, three lines from the bottom. He quotes in the name of a Chuvas Masas Binyamin, Mem Beis, HaKlal Hu, Simen Muvok, Hu Shulayim Sarak Echad Me'elef. If one in a thousand people have such a scar, one in a thousand people are missing a toe or a finger or something like similar, they have such a tattoo or, you know, something like that. So then that would be a reliable Simen. And you could, even if you don't have testimony to seeing his face, you could rely on that as an identifying characteristic, allow the wife to remarry and to commence avelus. What if it is dental records? The Rav Moshe writes is like a simen beinoni. They didn't assume that that was a simen muvak. But I don't know what the reliability of dental records are, but it was a little bit higher than that. But he says if it's one in a thousand, that already rises to the level of a simen muvhak. What about identifying someone based on his utensils or his clothing? So the Gemara says, has a debate in the Gemara, not if it's just like a red shirt or a white shirt. Let's say something we know is his, but are we chashin on the she'ela or not? Are we afraid that maybe he lent the t-shirt to somebody else? And that's why this corpse is wearing the t-shirt, but it's not necessarily him. So Gemara is a debate about whether or not we're chashin on the she'ela. It's a machlekes in Shulchan Aruch. A machlekes had a paskin. Machlekes we shayin. Machlekes in the Pischei Tshuva. Are we chashin on the she'ela that he lent it to somebody else or not? However, the Gemara does stipulate if it's something that people generally don't lend, like a wallet or a signet ring, or the Gemara says a saddle of an animal, which is custom made for every animal. So you don't lend these items out. And the Gemara said that would be conclusive proof to identify the remains and allow the woman to remarry. And that's quoted by the Beis Shmuel also over here, over in Oisi Dal, the fourth line, nearly Iker, the Loi Chashin L'Sheela Ba'arniki V'Taboz K'mashmaos HaSugya. That just like the Gemara implies, if it's something that people generally don't lend out, the Beis Shmuel accepts that as valid way of identifying the remains and assuming that the husband has passed away and allow the wife to remarry. This was actually in the tragic situation of September 11th, there were many husbands who were trapped, men who were trapped in the Trade Center, and it was hard to, about 20 or so, I think, situations, hard to establish that they certainly were killed in the towers. I have been able to place them there, but we don't know, we don't necessarily know what happened. Maybe they escaped, maybe they were killed, we don't know. So every situation had to be dealt with. So one situation, they found, tragically, found the remains of the husband, his pants and his wallet and his keys in a pocket. They found in the rubble. So that was one of the major considerations that they relied upon, but they didn't deal with this, relied upon allowing that woman to remarry. Because that was his items. You know, people generally don't lend out their wallets, generally they don't lend their pants with the wallet inside of it, lend that to somebody else. Be exceedingly rare. So that's what it says in the Beis Shmuel. We could rely on that kind of conclusive, that kind of assumption, that identifying item to assume that these are to identify the remains and allow the wife to remarry and commence avelus. In the Tshuvas of the Chemda Shlomo, the Marashal, he writes, that's what Yaakov Avinu was relying on as well. He got the Ksainas Pahasim, was dipped in blood. And they told him, HaKer Na Ksainas Bin Chayim Loi, is this the Ksainas Pahasim of your son? And he began to commence avelus. How could he do that? No one gave him testimony that Yosef was dead. What did he rely on? So, and we said that's the same rule, the same standard that we require in order to allow a woman to remarry, to assume the husband is dead, we require in order to begin to commence avelus. So the Chemda Shlomo says, must be, because he assumed that the Ksainas Pasim is a garment Yosef would never have lent out. And we're not chashin on the she'el on such a garment. And therefore, he took it as conclusive proof that Yosef was dead, and that's why he began to commence avelus. The problem is, if that's the precedent, meaning this is the source for that. The problem is, yeah, he was wrong. Yosef was still alive. So it seemed to undermine this as really conclusive proof of identifying that a person is passed away from Yaakov Avinu, beginning of Eilus for Yosef, because it didn't work out like that. Yosef was still alive. At the same time, that's what it seems to be accepted by, you know, the Yosef's situation notwithstanding. That seems to be the standard with regards to Avelos, as long as we find a garment, a kalim, that could, generally people don't lend out, we could identify the remains based on that and assume that the person has passed away and allow the woman to remarry and to begin Avelos. However, in the 1980s, 1990s, they developed genetic blood testing, but DNA testing. That was the first time it was used in criminal cases and in the court of law. So it's really new technology. And certainly at the time of September 11th, it was something that was very new. So how should halacha react to a DNA testing? And that also was one of the major considerations in identifying remains, where they found body parts in the tragic situation of September 11th and trying to help each one of the agunos remarry. I believe all of them were given heta to remarry pretty quickly, relatively. But I think the last one was like 9 months or a year after September 11th. They all were given a heta to remarry based on different combination of different considerations. But one major consideration was, can we identify, or you know, let's say we identify the remains with DNA evidence, can that be acceptable in the eyes of halacha? So the tshuva was sent to from the Beis Din of America to Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Also Rav Avadya Yosef was involved. And Rav Zalman Nechemia wrote a tshuva to the Beis Din of America, which was later printed in a journal called Chumen, and a journal called Yeshurun, and our yeshiva journal called Tzvi at the time, that he argued that DNA evidence, identifying remains based on a DNA test, can be assumed to be a simen muvhak. He argued it's even greater than a simen muvhak. He said because that's like seeing a person himself. That's like looking at a person's face. Is seeing their DNA. That's not a simen muvhak. He said a simen is a generic identifying, unique characteristic, which doesn't necessarily tell me it belongs to him or not. Just, you know, the guy has a scar over here that's shaped like that. That's generic. But what is the likelihood that it's found on two people in the exact same way? That's a simen. Simen muvhak means it's really unlikely, really unusual. What's the difference between that and seeing a person's face? Seeing a person's face is seeing him. That's not a generic quality that happens to be found by, is unlikely to be found by the two, same people. This is seeing the person himself. So too he argued when the DNA test, that's not seeing a generic quality that, is just unlikely that it's, possessed by two people. This is like seeing the person himself when a DNA test matches. Others, so definitely it would be, he argued it would be a simen muvhak, but independently would be grounds to identify the remains and allow Aguna to remarry. Others argued, though, on a number of grounds. The first is that how do they know that there's really no one out there with the same DNA? The DNA tests are presumed to be accurate, it's like 1 in 7.5 quadrillion. Which is more people than ever existed in the history of the world. So that's the odds of all of the markers matching up on the different points in the DNA strand that they compare. However, others argue, how do you know? How do you know that there's no one in the world who shares the same DNA? Have you tested everybody in the world to know that no one in the world has the same DNA?
Can you just respond to that, most people aren't going to have that, why would we assume?
Well, just remember, this was in 2001, September 11th, so it was very new at the time, and certainly in the halakhic world, hadn't been addressed.
Right.
So people were skeptical, and there's a general, skepticism towards some scientific advancement, which take time to integrate into the halakhic system, and that was one of the skepticisms that people had. How do you know? Yeah.
Isn't it the nature of DNA to be unique?
How do you know that?
It's inherent in...
How do you know that? So they argue, how do you know? Have you tested everybody? How do you know? So Zalman Nechemia argued that, Chazal tell us, just like no two people, ein partzufeim, doimin zalazeh, no two people have the same face. He says, how did Chazal know? Did they tour the entire world and take photographs of everybody? How did they know? So Rav Zalman Nechemiah says, must be just anecdotally, they looked around, nobody has the same face, and they concluded from that, hey, that nobody in the world has the same face. Could there be, you know, a doppelganger out there somewhere exactly the same as you? It could be, but Chazal assumed that it didn't exist. So too, he argues, the same should be true with regards to DNA. That since we haven't come across two people who share the same DNA, we can assume that that exists throughout the general population. Others argue that Chazal told us, ein partzufeim doimin zelazeh. Chazal never told us, ein DNA shavin zelazeh. So who's to say that that's really the case? As some argued in that fashion. Zalman Nechemi assumes DNA is like seeing a picture. You know, of Yitzhak Ochanan, who was renowned as, for his involvement in Aguna cases, argued, let's say you see a picture of a person after he passes away. Nowadays, in our times, we know pictures can be doctored and things like that. Pictures and even video... we all know that these things can be highly doctored. But in those days, it was something with it. So you saw a person, a corpse, picture of the corpse of a husband. That was conclusive proof. It's like you saw the person that he passed away and allowed the woman to remarry. So Zalman Nechemiah assumes the same is true if you find the DNA remains. It's like seeing a picture of the person. And others argue that how do you know that just based on DNA that this is him? Maybe there are two people out there in the world who share the same DNA. Another argument that was made is that there's a tremendous amount of lab error, which, you know, the Innocence Project and things like that, does occur. So in the time of September 11th, I believe I was told that they sent the DNA evidence that was submitted by the families, victims' families, to one lab in one corner of the country. They sent the remains to another. One was in, like, Washington, one was in the South, and one was up here. So they sent the remains to one place, they sent the stuff people submitted somewhere else, and then they put together the results in a third laboratory to avoid coarse contamination, which is a big problem in matching DNA evidence one to the other. So they tried to avoid that problem of lab error, but there are still some who are suspect of DNA evidence because of the lab error. But in the same journal, the Truman, he quotes there from Rav Nissen Karelitz, a true Rav Nissen Karelitz, and Rav Vosner, also at the time, similar time period of September 11th, dealing with that tragedy, that they argued that DNA evidence is a simon beinoni, simon emtoi. It's a simon, but to call it a conclusive simon, you know, an absolute conclusive simon, a simon muvhak, they found difficult for two other reasons. They mentioned those two concerns we had, but also two other ones. The first being that if you know how DNA evidence is processed, they take different points along the DNA strand and compare them one to the other. What they call a locus, one point compared to the other. And if the same bases or, you know, whatever. So they compare many points, 14 or more, up to 20, 21. So each one independently is not a identifier. It's only the series of all together. So is that called a simon? If it's only because of a bunch of different points coming together in a series, not one of them independently rises to the level of a simon muvhak. So the truth of the matter is, the Beis Shmuel already deals with that. He writes over here, I gave it to you, Yudalit, the Beis Shmuel and Evan Ezra, Simon Yudzayin, writes about simon emtsoi mistarfim, even though the Ramah says, if you have many simonim guruim, the guy is short, and he was wearing a red shirt, and he's fat. That doesn't add up to anything. Short guy, fat, red shirt, all simanim geruim. Not identifying characteristics that are not unusual at all. So many non-unusual things don't add up to become unusual. So, but the Beis Shmuel says, let's say you have many things that are, you know, somewhat unusual, and all of them line up. Then he says, that's a simon muvhak b'yoser. What is the likelihood of all of these things semi-unusual? It's not short and fat. Half the population is either short or tall. Half the population is either skinny or fat. So that doesn't tell you anything. But what if it's unusual? There's many options could be at each one of the points of the analyzed in the DNA strand, and they won't match up. That's highly unusual. That's a simon muvhak b'yoser, and that was the argument that many made. But the final argument that they had was, is that generally speaking, in the eyes of Allah, we only recognize those things that are visible to the human eye. it discussed when it comes to Malchalas Asurais, if one eats a bacteria or a bug that's invisible to the human eye, the Torah never prohibited such items. Or our tefillin have to be square, but Ramesh writes in the Igros Maisha that they all have to be square to the degree that the human eye can detect. If they look square, that's considered to be square. So you see that the Torah, and this is true throughout almost every area of halacha, that the Torah recognizes only, with regard to the fulfillment of mitzvahs and violation of yisurim, only recognizes those things that are visible to the human eye. They argue DNA is not visible to the human eye. So I think one could respond to that argument that it's true that the Torah only recognizes that which is visible to the human eye when you're fulfilling mitzvahs and with regards to the violation of yisurim. Because the Torah told us to fulfill a mitzvah. The Torah told us to restrict ourselves from doing certain actions. What was it referring to? It's probably referring to the things we can see. You can't expect more from me than is that which I can perceive with my human eye. If I can't see the bug, how can you prohibit me from eating it? So perhaps, the Torah, when it gave us these mitzvahs and prohibited us from doing these actions, only limited to that which we can perceive with the human eye. However, in identifying remains, either this is the person or this isn't the person, and who's to say that all of our methods of identifying remains have to be visible to the human eye? The Torah doesn't recognize things that are, we don't recognize illnesses that travel, in a virus which is not visible to the human eye. We probably would. To the fact that it's not visible to the human eye doesn't mean that it's not on the radar of the Torah. What it means is you can't expect me in my fulfillment of the mitzvahs of violation of Yisurim to be accountable for things that I can't see. That's not what the Torah had in mind when the mitzvahs were given. But the fact to identify remains seems to be that a person should be able to rely on that. And that was a major consideration. I don't think any one of the cases they relied solely on DNA evidence and they tried to account for all range of the poskim to make everybody happy in every situation, which is what we always do in a guna situation. We don't want anybody to have any reservations. So relied on a whole host of considerations in every single case, but many tzadim lekula. But DNA evidence did play a role in many of resolving many of the tragic situations of September 11th. But there is still this remaining machlekes that exists arayom hazeh within the community of Paiskim, particularly in Eretz Israel, where DNA Torah carry much more weight and enforceable things. Can we rely on DNA evidence in a monetary case, let's say? If it's a simon muvak, you could even perhaps decide a monetary case, take money from one party, award it to another party. But if it's a simon beinoni, a simon emtsoi, somewhere in the middle, perhaps that's not good enough to extract money from one party, award it to somebody else. Yeah.
I agree with the latter opinion that if you won't be able to see it with the visible eye, that would be only a simon beinoni. Why would that be, according to that opinion, wouldn't that be not a simon at all? Because you can't see with the human eye.